From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, more bombings in Baghdad, winding down a war on the Arabian Peninsula, and the continuing tragedy of the earthquake in Haiti. In Baghdad early this week, coordinated bombings left 36 people dead and more than 70 wounded. Suicide car bombers targeted three hotels frequented by foreigners. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro was near the site of one of the attacks, and she filed this report.
First came the shooting. Several insurgents attacking the front gate of the Hamra Hotel, then a minibus packed with explosives pushed through, detonating just yards away from the main entrance. The Hamra Hotel is popular with Western journalists. Several major news organizations are based there. Wissam Mahmoud works for NBC. He was standing on the balcony when the attack unfolded.
I saw the guard shooting for some insurgents. Then minibus stopped there and then exploded. I don't know what's happened after that.
The insurgents had sophisticated weapons, he says, and they overwhelmed the hotel's security guards.
It's just minutes after a massive explosion at the Hamra Hotel. Right in front of me is a large crater. The police right now are going through the rubble trying to look for any survivors. It looks like an earthquake has hit this area.
Two women are found underneath the debris. They hobble out screaming. The face of one of them is covered in white dust mixed with long streaks of red blood. May God kill the government, she shouts. Around her are mangled cars and chunks of flesh. A severed leg lies on the ground, trampled by the crowds. The insurgents targeted the Sheraton Hotel and the Babylon Hotel as well, in the same neighborhood of Karada. The blasts all happened within 10 minutes of each other, clearly a well-coordinated attack on places known to house foreigners. Iraq's elections are scheduled for March 7th, and security has become one of the main campaign issues. If the bombings were meant to show that the Iraqi government is not up to the task of protecting this city, then they succeeded, at least here. Miserable, this is miserable. This is a disastrous situation. Look at what happened, he says. The man declined to give his name, but the sentiment was echoed by many of the victims of the attack. Everyone here is our family, she says. We are all Iraqis. All of them are our sons. Security has improved across Iraq in recent years, but militants still have the ability to carry out spectacular attacks. The U.S. military has warned there could be an uptick in violence as the election draws near. But U.S. forces were nowhere to be seen in the direct aftermath of the Hamra bombing. They are no longer the first responders after withdrawing from Iraq's cities. And so, Iraq's security forces and the Iraqi government were the target of most people's ire. In what remained of the lobby of the Hamra Hotel, Wissam Mahmoud said he felt he would be secure here. Standing amid the torn curtains, blown-out windows, and splintered doors, he clutched his wounded arm.
It's too bad. Too bad. Before, we felt this place is a safer place in Baghdad, but now, no place safe. No place safe.
Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR News, Baghdad.
There are signs that one of Yemen's many crises, a battle against Shiite rebels in the north, may be cooling off. The leader of the rebel group, known as the Houthis, says his forces have withdrawn from neighboring Saudi Arabia, and he has offered the Saudis a ceasefire. The Saudis were drawn into the conflict late last year, but now they are claiming victory in expelling the rebels from their territory. Kelly McEvers traveled to the front lines with the Saudi military.
We are heading down toward Yemen on a Saudi military plane. Saudi officials repeatedly have claimed that they've expelled the rebels from a so-called buffer zone along the rugged border that the two countries share. Yet the body count has continued to rise on both sides. Saudis say that they'll make an announcement today about the offer for a truce that the Houthis have made. Once the plane lands, reporters are herded into four-wheel drive trucks. We pass checkpoints, military encampments, a field hospital, and abandoned villages that were evacuated back in November when Saudi Arabia joined the conflict. Now, thousands of villagers live in a sprawling tent camp. Our trucks head up a road that looks like it's been freshly cut into a steep mountain. Sniper nests have been carved out of the rock, and each peak is manned by an armed lookout. Up top, standing under a battered Saudi flag, Major General Saeed Al-Ghamdi says the Houthis controlled this strategic mountain, known as Jebel Dud, up to 2 weeks ago. But now the Saudis have retaken it. Here's Ghamdi's interpreter.
Our forces, they have sealed the roads and they cut off the enemy supplies.
Ghamdi points down the mountain toward what's left of a village he says the Houthis had occupied.
That area, which is called Al-Ladfan, they were buried in their places.
When asked about the Houthis' offer earlier this week to withdraw in exchange for a ceasefire, Ghamdi says there was no withdrawal, only defeat.
They are just justifying. They are justifying their weaknesses.
But despite the claims on both sides that the Houthis are now gone from Saudi territory, Captain Ahmed Mohammed Aswani says he recently fired on a Houthi sniper on this side of the border. How recently, a reporter asks.
Last night.
What, last night?
Yeah.
But how did they see them at night?
Aswani says the Houthis operate almost exclusively on foot and hide out in caves. And just across the border, the gunfire and shelling continues. Because reporters have been kept out of the battle zone all this time, it's difficult to verify exactly why the Saudis entered this conflict in the first place. The Houthis say they crossed into Saudi territory late last year because the Saudis were bombing them inside Yemen. The Saudis deny this. They say they only attacked the Houthis on Saudi soil after the Houthis killed Saudi border guards. Back down the mountain, Deputy Defense Minister Prince Khalid bin Sultan has arrived to inspect the troops. He says the Houthis will have to meet certain conditions before the Saudis agree to a full ceasefire.
If they want to prove what they said, they have to draw even the snipers, because every sniper there is, that means an attack in the Saudi soil.
And he said they have to return six Saudis who officials say are being held prisoner. Prince Khalid also offered a third condition aimed not at the Houthis, but at the Yemeni government.
I hope that, you know, the Yemeni armed forces would be as a buffer zone in the border.
Prince Khalid said the issue is now an internal problem for the government of Yemen. He spoke in front of a parade formation of hundreds of infantrymen and paratroopers ringed by heavy and light mobile artillery. Afterward, soldiers celebrated what might be the end of a three-month-long conflict. But then they returned to formation and back to their tents for the night. God willing, one commander said, we'll stay here as long as we're needed. For NPR News, I'm Kelly McEvers.
Everyone who survived the January 12th earthquake in Haiti will have permanent memories of what they lost. Loved ones, homes, cherished possessions. But some people will have constant, lifelong reminders, because they've lost parts of themselves. World Health Organization officials say there are already well over 1,000 people who have suffered amputations because of their injuries. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports on how they're trying to cope with those losses.
The Hôpital de la Paix is normally a children's hospital. Now it's packed with people of all ages with every kind of injury. An elderly lady is carried through the crowd on a sheet of plywood, her legs wrapped in stained bandages. A man holds an IV bag aloft for a very pregnant young woman. A determinedly cheerful woman leads the way through the wards.
You're inside. How are you? Good. How's your leg?
She's Ruth Duggan, a Canadian from Halifax, and she already knows a lot of the people here. Her white T-shirt says Handicap International, the French-based charity for which she's a volunteer. She's an occupational therapist, and she's here to get people back on their feet. Ruth makes her way to a corner of the ward where a young man is propped up in bed.
We're from Handicap International.
At the word handicap, the young man winces sharply and looks down at his legs. One is wrapped in bandages. The other is a stump about halfway down the calf. His name is Jean Saint-Fer, A handsome, slightly built 22-year-old. His older sister and brother flank him on each side of the bed. Speaking through an interpreter, Ruth explains that her organization provides prosthetic limbs and training for people with amputations. She says that his injury will make it relatively easy to fit a new leg.
So he'll be able to walk.
Jean Saint-Fer nods, but it's not clear whether he fully believes this. He's still reliving an experience that was much more than the loss of a limb. He's an engineering student, and he was buried in the wreckage of his classroom at the university when the earthquake struck.
It's a very sad story. He said that he was in a hole, and there wasn't water for him to drink. When he got thirsty, people who had already died, he sucked his sweat from their clothes so that he could survive.
Jean Saint-Fer survived by sucking the sweat from the clothes of the dead people lying near him. He says when he tries to imagine it now, it's like a dream. Ruth Duggan doesn't have a remedy for memories, but she has practical ways to get a young man walking again.
Okay, so some exercises. He needs to be able to sit up straight. No, make him work. And back down. Relax.
Everyone around Jean Saint-Fer smiles as he works the muscles of his stomach and his upper thigh, as much for their own reassurance as for his.
And stay until his leg starts to shake. Okay, back down. Good.
Jean Saint-Fer is scheduled to be moved to the University of Miami's hospital in Port-au-Prince soon, where doctors will be able to treat wounds and a fracture on his other leg. He'll get more physical therapy there as well, until Handicap International can fit him with a temporary prosthesis. Experts with the group say it's best to get people walking with prostheses as soon as possible, both for their own morale and for the recovery of the injured tissue. They say they're planning to provide permanent prostheses for people in the coming months, tough, durable limbs that are made for conditions in developing countries. They'll need more than 1,000 for people who've lost a part of themselves in the earthquake. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Port-au-Prince.
Coming up, a reporter's notebook from Port-au-Prince.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. Jason Bobian was among the NPR correspondents covering the earthquake. He sent us this reporter's notebook about some of the people he met.
For me, the hardest part is the living. There have been so many dead here. Corpses are so common, both on the street and oozing out of the wreckage, that it's the living who haunt me. The old man crumpled at the curb, calling out faintly, Mont Blanc, Mont Blanc, and asking for water. The crush wounds, the children who've lost or are about to lose an arm, a leg, or both. The bodies laid out at night like cordwood on the street. Lines of people wrapped in sheets perpendicular to the curb, sleeping on the pavement because either their house is gone or they're too terrified to go inside. In the first days after the quake, the women wailing into the night, later the dogs that survive and howl. A young woman alone down at the port. She sits on a bag with all of her belongings, waiting to catch a boat out. She lists the members of her family who died, mother, father, sister, cousin. It's just me now, she says, 22 years old and alone. Another woman says there isn't a single family in Haiti that isn't crying right now. She's trying to dig her brother-in-law's body out of a pile of debris. There's the fear of being inside, walking with my translator through her old neighborhood, her nervousness that any teetering building might crash down on us at any moment. An aftershock shakes the rubble under our feet. She runs for solid ground. What is it like to watch your entire city crumble around you? Walls, roofs, meant to protect you, become projectiles, blunt instruments, traps. How do you ever go back inside? A huge challenge lies ahead just to feed and house the people of Haiti in the coming weeks. Then block after city block needs to be bulldozed. But for Haiti to be reborn and to avoid becoming a wasteland kept alive on international aid, the living need to heal. They need to dream of a new country and move forward. Jason Beaubien, NPR News.
For more international news, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts. Azunke, pare.